This is VOA News. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey. Author Salman Rushdie has been attacked as he was about to give a lecture in Western New York State. AP correspondent Joshua Goodman was in the audience when a man stormed the stage and attacked Rushdie.
So I'm at the Chautauqua Institution. It's a place of study and reflection and religious inquisitiveness, and it's now a crime scene. Back here at the amphitheater, there were about 2,500 people waiting to hear Salman Rushdie speak. He had just walked onto the stage, was still being introduced less than a minute before the event began, after the event began, and a man rushed from this audience up onto the stage and started punching or stabbing. It wasn't quite clear, but there was clearly some sort of blood or red liquid going in many directions. A collective sigh of shock from the audience, many of whom are here to, you know, contemplate the problems of the world, not to see them up close. And eventually the scene was, the amphitheater was evacuated. It's now a crime scene. The man was detained. We're not really sure the status of Salman Rushdie. There has been a fatwa, an order for him to be killed on his life for many, many decades now. We're waiting to hear from authorities what his status is and what prompted this brazen, senseless, and very scary attack.
Rushdie's book, The Satanic Verses, has been banned in Iran since 1988, and many Muslims consider it to be blasphemous. A year later, Iran issued a fatwa or edict calling for his death. A more than $3 million bounty has been offered for anyone who kills Rushdie. Find more at voanews.com or follow us on the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. Montenegro State TV reports a man went on a shooting rampage after a family dispute, killing 11 people on the streets before being shot dead in a gun battle with police. State TV RTCG reported the 34-year-old gunman wounded six people, including a policeman, Friday. RTCG, quoting witnesses, said the attacker was randomly shooting at people walking in the street in Montenegro, including at children. The head of Kenya's Electoral Commission says vote tallying in the country's close presidential election isn't moving fast enough. Meanwhile, parallel counting by local media dramatically slow amid public concerns about censorship or meddling. With no clear winner emerging and perhaps days more to wait, social media is busy with unverified claims by candidate supporters. Human rights groups call that dangerous in a country with a history of political violence. Kenya could see a runoff presidential election for the first time. Following recent India demonstrations and detentions of opposition figures, there's a growing sentiment that India's democracy is in retreat and its democratic foundations are floundering. AP correspondent Charles de la Desma reports.
At 75 years old, India's democracy is under pressure like never before. Experts and critics say trust in the judiciary as a check on executive power is eroding, and religious minorities are facing increasing attacks by Hindu nationalists. Journalist and author Kumi Kapoor says assaults on the press and free speech have grown more brazen in recent years.
There's no question. I mean, one has only to look around to see that the media has certainly shriveled up during Mr. Modi's regime.
Kapoor, however, says Indian people's restless and independent spirit will not be broken.
You can clamp down on the media, but you can't really clamp down on freedom of thought and expression in a country like India.
Observers say democratic backsliding has accelerated since Prime Minister Narendra Modi came to power in 2014. I'm Charles de la Desma.
Recapping our top story, author Salman Rushdie has been attacked and apparently stabbed in the neck as he was about to give a lecture in Western New York. An Associated Press reporter witnessed a man storm the stage Friday and begin punching or stabbing Rushdie as he was being introduced. The author was taken down or fell to the floor and the man was restrained. Rushdie's book, The Satanic Verses, has been banned in Iran since 1988. And many Muslims consider it to be blasphemous. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The challenge we're having is that the political will is not there, especially from the presidency. There is no clear-cut directive on what to do.
That security analyst Senator Irugbu saying Nigerian authorities have moved the country's insecurity and are ramping up ways to solve it. Details coming up also. Clashes between police and protesters in Sierra Leone kills 13 people. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Germany has announced it is halting some military operations with the United Nations peacekeeping mission in Mali. Germany's defense minister said the decision stems from Malian authorities denying overflight rights to German military aircraft. The suspension marks the latest falling out between European forces and Mali's military government, as Annie Reisenberg reports from Bamako, Mali.
German Defense Minister Christine Lambrecht said in a statement that because Malian leaders of the UN mission to Mali, MINUSMA, denied overflight rights, the German mission must stop all reconnaissance and transport operations until further notice. The comments from Lambrecht were posted Friday to the Defense Ministry's Twitter account. In them, Lambrecht said she had spoken with Malian Defense Minister Sadio Camara to describe to him the irritations about problems with denial of flight permissions. Lambrecht also said that Germany can only stay involved with MINUSMA in Mali if this doesn't happen again, and we are welcomed in the country. Germany provides more than 1,000 soldiers to the UN mission to Mali. There was no immediate comment from Malian and MINUSMA officials. The episode is another sign of tension between Mali's military rulers and foreign military forces stationed in Mali to help stabilize the country. In July, Mali arrested 49 soldiers from Ivory Coast who came to Mali to support a UN contingent, calling them mercenaries. After MINUSMA spokesperson Olivier Salgado said on Twitter that Mali had been notified of the soldiers' arrival, he was expelled from the country. French forces are in the final stages of withdrawing from Mali, following increasing tensions with the government and concerns over Mali working with mercenaries from the Wagner Group, a private Russian military company with ties to the Kremlin. The government has said it works only with official Russian instructors. Earlier this week, Mali received a shipment of military aircraft from Russia, the latest of multiple shipments of aircraft and weapons from the country's new ally in the decade-long fight against Islamist insurgents. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, praises Liberia for removing gender discrimination from its national law, granting women the same right as men to pass their nationality to their children. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
With the stroke of a pen, Liberian President George Weah amended the country's Aliens and Nationality Law on August 5th, removing the primary cause of statelessness among children. The UN Refugee Agency calls the act hugely significant. It says the amended law gives women the same rights as men to confer their nationality on their children. Heretofore, children were unable to access the rights of citizenship if the father was absent or unknown. Under the new act, UNHCR spokeswoman Shabia Mantu tells VOA, children will be able to benefit from their mother's citizenship even if there is no man in the picture. That, she says, will spare many children from becoming stateless and deprived of multiple rights.
This has major implications from the cradle to the grave. It really can exclude people from the rights and assistance and services that other citizens may have, but limiting their access to education, healthcare, documentation, and also exposing them to risks of lifelong discrimination and exclusion, as well as violence, abuse, and trafficking.
In 2014, the UNHCR estimated there were at least 10 million stateless people in the world when it began its I Belong campaign to end statelessness by 2024. Data from 94 countries collected in 2019 put that number at around 4.2 million, a figure the UNHCR considers to be grossly underestimated. Mantu says 24 countries in the world today continue to have gender discriminatory provisions in their nationality laws. She says Liberia is the latest country to reform the law and end the gender discriminatory provision.
We know that statelessness, it's a global phenomenon. We know in West Africa there are apparently at least 1.6 million stateless people, people of undetermined nationality, and that's according to government figures. But it's a pervasive issue. So this is a really momentous milestone in this campaign and the effort to prevent and resolve statelessness.
Madagascar reformed its nationality laws, guaranteeing the equal right of citizens, regardless of their gender, on January 25, 2017. 6 months later, on July 5th, Sierra Leone became the second African country to legislate gender discriminatory reforms. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Human Rights Watch says Cameroon's military executed at least 10 people while fighting rebels this year in the country's troubled western regions. The rights group says troops committed other abuses, including forced disappearances, burning homes, and destroying health facilities. Cameroon's military has yet to comment on the report, but last month, the country's defense minister acknowledged such abuses for the first time and ordered troops to stop. Moki Edwin Kindeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Human Rights Watch says in a report that between April 24 and June 12 of this year, Cameroonian soldiers summarily executed 10 civilians, burned 12 homes, arbitrarily detained at least 26 people, and are presumed to have forcibly disappeared up to 17 others. The report released Thursday says the abuses were carried out in and around Belu, Chomba, and Misong, towns in Cameroon's northwest region, during operations against armed separatist groups. In one incident on April 24, Cameroon government troops stopped, severely beat and detained over 30 motorbike riders who were part of a funeral convoy, allegedly because the soldiers suspected them of being separatist fighters. Human Rights Watch says about 17 riders are presumed forcibly disappeared as their whereabouts are unknown, but they were last seen in military custody. Ilaria Alegrozi is Human Rights Watch Central Africa researcher. She says the abuses are causing untold suffering among civilians.
We are facing a situation where the army is supposed to be protecting the civilian population from the threats posed by the separatist fighters is committing serious human rights violations against civilians, causing frustrations and also more suffering and leading to displacement.
Human Rights Watch says serious abuses by separatist fighters, including killing and kidnapping of civilians, and attacks on students, teachers, and schools were also documented during the same period. Ngong Sipren, a 27-year-old sports teacher, says he fled from Belu after government troops torched his house in June. He spoke by a messaging app from the town of Douala, where he has relocated.
I, just like many other people, would want to go back to Belu. But how can we, when both the military and the separatists torture us? My house was burned by the military. I saw them burn my house before then. My wife, who is a teacher, was adopted by the fighters.
Separatist groups said on social media they will investigate and punish fighters who abuse human rights, but blame Cameroon government troops for what they call a majority of the abuses. Contacted by VOA after the report was published, Cameroon's military spokesman Cyril Serge Atongfak Ngemo promised to get back to reporters, but has not done so. But on June 19, during the installation of military officials fighting separatists in Bamenda, capital of the Northwest region, Cameroon's defense minister acknowledged that troops committed grave rights abuses against civilians and ordered such violations to stop. In June, Cameroon's military said it arrested four of its troops for killing nine civilians, including four women and a baby, in the northwest village of Misong, describing the act as reckless. Human Rights Watch says the media and international community have been very quiet about the crisis wrecking Cameroon's western region, making the armed conflict one of the most neglected crises in the world. The crisis degenerated into an armed conflict in Cameroon's English-speaking western regions in 2016 after teachers and lawyers protested the dominance of French speakers in the officially bilingual country. The military responded with a crackdown and rebels took up arms, saying they had to defend the minority English speakers. The UN says that clashes between the two sides have left at least 3,300 people dead and more than 750,000 internally displaced. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Observers say the future of Tunisia and President Kais Saied may depend on several factors, from whether the president can secure and sell a crucial International Monetary Fund rescue loan or dealing with powerful players such as the main trade union and the armed forces. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi discussed whether the Tunisian president could succeed in balancing these crucial factors with William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington.
Not himself, and the IMF file is to some degree controlled by the prime minister, who's pushed back on that issue quite a bit, and the finance minister, who actually operate in this area a little bit independently of the president. The history of the IMF loan was that when the coup happened, a deal was almost finished. There are conflicting views on this, both inside and outside the U.S. government, of how close they were to a deal. But my sources say that the deal was not only fairly close to done, and my sources inside the IMF, but that it was generous to Tunisia, and the austerity wasn't as tough as they said. Since the coup, the trend has been, both within the IMF and outside the IMF, to want to increase the conditions on Tunisia. I think one of the mistakes that's been made was a discussion of political conditionality on Tunisia. That usually doesn't work. The IMF loans work much better if there's economic conditionality, not political conditionality. And I think Tunisia will have to get back to democracy other than by withholding an IMF loan. The U.S. and France are very much in favor of a loan going through. I think they do want a degree of economic conditionality, but it doesn't have to be austerity. It just has to be improving Tunisia's balance sheet, which means less salaries and less subsidies on the balance sheet, which are incredibly costly to the Tunisian government. Tunisia has one of the most government-heavy budgets in all of Africa and the world. And so the way you do this is you remove people from government payrolls while making sure that they're included in other payrolls or have access to funds so they don't fall into poverty. And the same thing with subsidy. And Tunisia is moving the direction of targeting subsidies towards people that actually need subsidies rather than national subsidies that everybody gets the same subsidy, even if they're middle class or rich. Now, when the IMF delegation was in Tunisia, the last one a couple of months ago, the president basically told them, go talk to the labor union. They're the problem, which, of course, isn't the way to go about this. Because the labor union isn't the problem. The labor union is trying to defend jobs, which it should do, and subsidies, which it's taken on, because it doesn't want Tunisians to be heavily impacted by any austerity measures that come with the IMF loan. But again, the way to do this, you target the money at the people that need it rather than target the money at everybody. And then you need to jumpstart the private sector. And jumpstarting the private sector means getting, in many respects, the government out of the way of the private sector.
How about the president's calculations of powerful players such as the armed forces in Tunisia?
In terms of the armed forces, I think the armed forces simply want the Tunisian democratic transition to get back on track, and they want the economy to be performing. And again, that also means the military getting out of the way as well. And so, as I said, they've got to pull back their forces from parliament and allow the Tunisian people to govern themselves.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. Reports from Sierra Leone say clashes between police and protesters have killed 13 people, with more than 100 others arrested during a curfew. A police spokesperson said normalcy is returning today, as Victoria Munga reports from VOA's African News Center in Nairobi, Kenya.
An interim report released by Sierra Leone's police Thursday shows that 113 people were arrested in protests that began Monday. A majority were arrested in the northeast region of Makeni. Police say public and private property has been vandalized in the protests, and three police stations were burned. No new protests were reported Friday, and Sierra Leone's Assistant Police Commissioner Brima Kamara told VOA in a phone interview that normalcy was beginning to return.
All the banks are open.
He says all banks are open. Offices are open, both government offices and private offices, save for some few shops. Demonstrators took to the streets this week to express anger over the soaring cost of living in Sierra Leone, which has nearly doubled in months. A 2020 World Bank report says 80% of Sierra Leone's population is poor, the majority living in rural areas. The Reuters news agency, citing a source in Freetown City mortuary, said 13 people were killed in clashes between police and protesters. In a Twitter post, Sierra Leone's President Julius Maada Bio termed the protest unfortunate and said the state would investigate their cause. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Nigeria's Air Force says airstrikes this week killed 55 members of criminal gangs who were involved in abduction for ransom operations. An Air Force spokesman says after the airstrikes, the militants released people they were holding hostage. Nigeria's government has come under heavy criticism for failing to stop mass abductions and Islamist militant attacks. Timothy Obiezu has more from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
The Nigerian Air Force says airstrikes in North Central Kaduna State on Tuesday killed 28 members of a kidnapping for ransom gang, including a gang leader. It says many others were injured. Air Force Public Relations Director Gabriel Gapquet told reporters that authorities had received intelligence that the bandits were gathering in the area. He said the success of the raid led to the release of captives held by the bandits. Gapquet said other airstrikes in northwestern Katsina State this week killed 27 bandits. He did not take calls from VOA for further comment. The airstrikes come a week after Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari presided over a national security meeting and said he had given security forces the full freedom to deal with terrorists. Darlington Abdullahi, president of the Alumni Association of Nigeria's National Defense College, says the president's words were a morale booster for troops.
This kind of thing should not come as a surprise. All you need is the political will to guide the action of the forces. I think they're getting probably that support that is required to deal with the situation. From the utterances of Mr. President.
But Gapquet said the military has also been conducting air operations targeting insurgents in northeastern Borno State. He said that included an August 6th raid in the village of Gazuwa that followed intelligence that terrorists from Boko Haram and splinter group Islamic State West Africa Province, ISWAP, were fighting each other. Nigeria has been fighting an Islamist insurgency in the northeast for more than 12 years. Authorities have been heavily criticized for failing to address general insecurity that stems from the insurgency and rampant kidnapping. Abdullahi says the military must stay on the offensive.
As long as this continues, I think the military still has opportunity to take on them before they organize themselves properly. I think the security agencies really have to continue the efforts, you know, to deal with the situation decisively.
Earlier this week, police said they had arrested four suspects connected to a church attack in the southwest state of Ondo that killed 40 worshippers. But security analyst Senator Irebu says authorities have shown a lack of political will to address the problem far too long.
The challenge we're having is that the political will is not there. especially from the presidency. There is no clear-cut directive on what to do. Anytime you hear that he's sounding frustrated, they keep on pushing the blame to others, not taking responsibility, not taking charge.
In July, Islamic State West Africa Province claimed responsibility for a jailbreak in Abuja that freed over 400 inmates, including high-profile terrorism detainees. Only a few of the prisoners have since been recaptured. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has called on countries around the world to place sanctions and other penalties on the Iranian-backed terrorist group Hezbollah. The call came on the anniversaries of two heinous Hezbollah attacks. The first, on July 18, 1994, was the bombing of the Jewish Community Center AMIA in Buenos Aires. The second was the bombing of a bus of Israeli tourists in Bulgaria exactly 18 years later. The attack on the Jewish Community Center in Argentina killed 85 people and wounded hundreds more. In Bulgaria, 5 Israelis were killed, along with the Bulgarian bus driver, and 45 Israeli youths were injured. Both attacks were carried out with the support of Iranian officials. In a statement on the anniversary, State Department spokesperson Ned Price noted that the AMIA attack in Buenos Aires was the single deadliest anti-Semitic attack in more than half a century. He called it a clear example of Iran's support for international terrorism. High-level Iranian government officials were directly implicated in the attack, and Hezbollah carried it out at the direction of the Iranian regime, he wrote. While no one responsible has been brought to justice, the United States believes all Argentines deserve to have those responsible held accountable for this despicable and cowardly act. Deborah Lipsett, U.S. Special Envoy to Monitor and Combat Anti-Semitism, who was in Argentina on the anniversary of the attack, also reaffirmed U.S. support for those seeking accountability for the horrific actions of that day. In Bulgaria, 2 Hezbollah operatives were convicted in absentia in connection with the bus bombing, but because their whereabouts are unknown, justice has yet to be served. The United States is committed to countering Hezbollah and Iran's malign influence, said State Department spokesperson Price. The funding, training, weapons, and other support Iran provides Hezbollah support complex and heinous terrorist acts like these. The callous murder of civilians must not stand, he declared. With our support, more than a dozen countries across Europe, South America, Central America, and the Pacific have issued national-level designations, bans, or other restrictions against Hezbollah. We urge more countries to take similar measures, which make it harder for the group and its backers in Tehran to threaten peace and security around the globe.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suwuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station.